Jesus Christ is King, and in Him we find our salvation. Thanks be to God. Thank you, choir, for that message. By the way, I was in choir practice this Wednesday night. They're already hard at work on our Christmas music. I saw more than 20 of them in there rehearsing. Just can't always get them all here on the same Sunday. But they are working. It's going to be wonderful. We look forward to that day in December. Well, during the choir anthem, thanks to the wonders of modern technology, while the choir was singing, I was able to listen in on you. It's amazing, if you have a loud thought, I can hear it now these days. And folks had looked ahead, they'd heard the scripture reading, the Ten Commandments, and they realized that the sermon is going to be from the Ten Commandments. And so your reactions, I was able to listen in on. You didn't know it, but in fact, all of our reactions. Somebody said, "Wow, am I reading that right? The sermon is coming from the Ten Commandments today. This ought to be interesting." Somebody else said, "I hope this won't be too judgmental. I'm feeling enough pain from my own memory of things I've done. I get it. I messed up, and I've asked God to forgive me." Someone else was thinking and realized where the sermon was coming today, and they said, "Finally, it took him long enough, but I'm not sure that boy's got it in him to give it to those sinners who need saving. We'll see." Somebody else said, "Ooh, this is giving me the heebie-jeebies. The pastor of my church growing up used to beat us up with the Ten Commandments regularly, and if that's the path to Jesus Christ, I just don't get it." Someone in this room said, "If anyone thinks I didn't hit this hard enough for their taste today, I'm going to invite them to stay after the service for a service of confession that'll begin at noon. It'll begin with a public telling of it all, starting with them." Oh, that was me. Oh. And someone else said, "I'm listening for a word of grace that takes sin seriously." Takes sin seriously. But also sounds like a Christian New Testament understanding of the bigger picture. Well, I remember our Sunday routine in my childhood like it was yesterday. Times were simpler then, and options for entertainment and enrichment were fewer and simpler as well. After breakfast, we would listen to the Protestant Hour, now called Day One Radio, coming from our kitchen radio while we were getting ready for church. Somehow, even though the radio was in the kitchen, you could hear it all over the house. And so we would listen to those sermons while we were getting ready. Voices like Carlisle Marnie, John Redhead, John Claypool, Tom Long, and Bill Self graced its airwaves. And then off we would go for a morning at the Roswell First Baptist Church. Now, many Sundays we left the church at noon after Sunday school and services and headed for Morrison's cafeteria. And early on we had to drive across the river to nearby Sandy Springs because we weren't big enough town to have a Morrison's cafeteria. But then Roswell grew enough and we got our own location and we went there most weeks. And on the weeks we didn't, it always meant my mom had made a pot roast. Now, her pot roast was good, and the carrots and potatoes were fall apart tender, just in case you're curious. And the rich pot liquor, fancier people would call it pan sauce, over cornbread and served with some coleslaw went down well too, accompanied by the inevitable afternoon movie and, for the adults, usually a nap. Now, there were only three TV stations at the time, if you didn't count PBS, and much to our loss and my sorrow, we didn't count PBS. And so you take those three stations, all probably showing a movie of some kind, and your choices were very limited. Now, of those three stations showing the movies, there seemed like there were only two kinds of movies you could have seen. One was Army movies, right? Army movies and epic Bible stories. That was your two choice. Well, okay, Elvis movies was probably the third category. But they didn't come on as often. So it seems I must have seen Charlton Heston as Moses receive the Ten Commandments 300 times when I was growing up. If you add in the inevitable showing of that giant film at Easter, surely the number 300 can't be far off. And Rebecca Pritchard describes this well. She says, "The great I am speaks from the heavens in a voice that literally thunders. The Holy One is above it all, yet claiming our attention. Moses, the leader, the prophet, climbs the mountain, dares to enter the stormy clouds of divine presence. The rest of us are at the foot of the mountain, trembling. God speaks directly to Moses. The maker of heaven and earth has spoken. The prophet carries the sacred stones down to the rest of the earthlings. They will listen to Moses, but are still afraid of the voice in the clouds." Now, if by now you've gotten past the pot roast and moved on to the movie I mentioned, you remember, as sure enough, how that was depicted. A deep, booming, and disembodied stage voice gave the commands to Moses in the Charlton Heston movie, as they were mysteriously laser etched into the stone tablets with fire spewing. I watched that scene in particular, fascinated at times, while I was chewing on a potato or maybe a stray onion. If I could somehow recreate this Sunday afternoon ritual, I think I would now, with much greater appreciation than I knew to have then. I have since realized that fancier people don't eat pot roast with or without cornbread or pot liquor, potatoes and carrots. That's sad, but I digress. Well, that's my childhood memory. Let's have an adult conversation about this scripture. The broken church sign still somehow shouts at people as they come down the street. The Ten Commandments are not multiple choice, it says, and some think that's cool, while others wonder why that'd be the first thing a church had once upon a time thought to spend money on a sign for. We've had battles over whether to have them posted in the courthouses and whether to have the ones that were posted taken down. We legalize and posture with the Ten Commandments, and unwittingly, many of us group them up and make them the mascot for our own biases and prejudices and convictions about the sins we don't struggle with. Absent any regard for the sins we do struggle with that are also addressed elsewhere in the Bible, if we dared to notice, but we don't dare notice. No, we like these 10. Truth is, most people can only count 9 in this list, forgetting that the first one is God's declaration about being God, which among other things means we're not, as I've pointed out to you already many times. And that's a big one, and probably as easy a command to violate as any of them are, at least unwittingly. If we're inclined to legalize and assault others with these, it's probably because we feel fairly safe with these 10 commandments, and we shouldn't feel safe. So let's keep looking at them. We have not fashioned for ourselves an idol of a false god, like the gold calf portrayed in the Big Moses movie. So we like that one relative to people of other faiths or of no faith at all. We forget how prone we are to fashioning God after our own images of ourselves, so that God gets in line and behaves and speaks just like we want God to. Somehow we don't notice that at times we are the idol we have fashioned. It doesn't seem to catch our eye that we believe God hates all the same people we do, so that probably ought to tell us something. Now, our mothers set us straight about any cussing that would use God's name, so we feel pretty good about that one, on taking the Lord's name in vain. Or if we are prone to do that, we make sure that we just don't do it when the preacher's around. And if we slip up and do that while the preacher's around, we make sure we apologize. We forget that the far more frequent way that we take the Lord's name in vain is when we want things or tout beliefs or distort beliefs that do things that run contrary to the true nature of God, and then represent those behaviors, those beliefs, those values as being of God anyway. We remember the Sabbath day and go to church, And believe me, I like it when you do this. That is one of my favorite things about you. You go to church. But sadly these days, more and more of us only do that when we haven't had a better offer that might involve Little League or a body of water or some family coming over to celebrate a big religious holiday, ironically. We keep a picture of our mothers and fathers in the other room, so we honor them, forgetting that the highest way we honor them is to live up to the best of their values and convictions and rise above their shortcomings. You shall not murder. Now, that one doesn't give most of us trouble, so these Ten Commandments are getting even better now. Forgetting that we can kill each other a little at a time, with a slight here, an untruth there, a mistreatment here, a taking for granted there, an oppression here. You shall not commit adultery. Charles, don't even go there. You're thinking. You shall not steal. And most of us haven't. Except in as much as we might not have shared with God a return of our resources, or we might still be trying to live into the greatest hope with which God has gifted us and created us and made us to be, all of us. You shall not bear false witness. Well, by now you get the idea. You haven't been called into court against your neighbor, so you're good to go on that one, except each one of us has secrets. Each one of us manipulates someone in our lives, holds back an insight here, doesn't shoot straight there. It's the same thing. You shall not covet your neighbor's house or BMW or slaves, their ox, their donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. I like my house. It's a nice house. My car is newer than my neighbor. My neighbor doesn't even own an ox or a donkey. I'm clear on this one. I forgot the wife. What a fascinating relationship we have with these Ten Commandments. And for those whose regard for these has become nearly idolatrous, moving the commands perhaps even ahead of the God who gave them, I think there's a curious blend of sociology and culturation and even some psychology at work that is fascinating. We who regard the Ten Commandments with a smug attitude, who hear them branding others as sinners, are probably relying on our memory of having read them once upon a time. I doubt adults who wield them have recently read them. For any of us who read these words and do not somehow feel smaller ourselves are no doubt holding them at arm's length. We are leaning on our memory of having studied them as children when we were in a more legalistic stage of child development, or we are perilously stuck in a legalistic stage of child development still. Adults who read these words would have to emerge humbled, fearful of their own relationship with God, such that it's hard to worry much about anyone else's at the moment. You have a danger of seeing me in a similar way the people did Moses. Now, lest that sound a bit self-absorbed, let me unpack what I mean about that. Moses was sent up on the mountain to meet with God and to bring back the words, and so he did. The people wanted him to tell them what God had said, as long as he didn't say anything too disagreeable. And once he did relay these commands, things got scary. And that might be why, sometime later, they institutionalized the priestly system. You want me to bring you some words each Sunday. You even built a permanent piece of furniture in the room for that purpose. But I hope we won't take that notion too far. In verse 18, look what happened. When all the people witnessed the thunder and lightning, the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, they were afraid and trembled and stood at a distance and said to Moses, "You speak to us and we'll listen, but do not let God speak to us or we will die." They knew what they'd done. They'd broken some of these commands even while Moses was gone up on the mountain to get them. Now something had happened right in front of them that they couldn't ignore. Signs of God's might. Symbols of God's seriousness. So they pled with Moses to step in between them and God. I don't think they were so much worried with Moses negotiating on their behalf at this point as they were in him shielding them from the boogeyman God that they feared so badly. They'd heard the commandments and been humbled by them. A light had been shined on their own lives. Now that's a genuine reaction, but important to us today. Notice that Moses immediately took them in another direction. Verse 20, Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for God has come only to test you and to put the fear of Him upon you so that you do not sin." And here's where I have to dance carefully. For that's where some might get fuel for their judgmentalism. Indeed, Moses is beckoning each individual and them collectively to step closer to God. To come closer to God as humbled and broken people. To worship and repent themselves and for themselves only. There's a play on words here if you caught it. Moses says, "Do not be afraid," or "fear not, because God has come only to test you and to put the fear of Him upon you so that you do not sin." That is, do not fear in the conventional sense, because what God really wants you to do is fear in the spiritual sense. That is, the use of fear to signify the proper reverence for God, the proper space in our lives for God to be God rather than us having to be our own little gods. And ironically, the wording understood in its Hebrew context does not seem to imply that if we would just keep these 10 rules, then we would never sin. Nowhere does that seem to be the idea. It's what we've done to the list. Because of course we know we will sin. Instead, the notion is to live in the proper relationship with God and to live in a general spirit of cooperation with God so that it is possible for us to be the most like God intended us as we can. Or as Terence Fretham says in his article on this section of Exodus, "The fear of God does not prompt obedience so much in the perfect keeping of a law code as it does obedience of the one who gave the code in the first place. It is the obedience of God, not the law. It is faithfulness to God, a yearning to live near God and within God's wishes, God's commands." And as we discussed only a few weeks ago, one of God's highest hopes in all of this was the health of the community itself. God was trying to preserve a way of living collectively for a people rather than set up a speed trap or an ID check to play gotcha with people who were a little too drunk on life. Does this make me soft on sin? Does this mean we can play fast and loose with God's commands? Read these sacred words again. Of course not. But the original hearers of these words, the people who were there as the story was first lived out, shrank before God when they heard these 10 commandments. They didn't puff out their chests. They didn't look over to see what the other person was doing. They were afraid and trembled. They fell before God and begged Moses to not let God speak to them. Like that time I got scared of Steve Padgett in our neighborhood and ran and hid behind my big brother. Rebecca Pritchard says it best, I think. She says, "We encounter the Holy One, the one to whom we belong, body and soul. We are reminded that this one is the great I Am of the burning bush, the one who leads us from slavery to freedom, who is utterly gracious and worthy of our worship and devotion. We come to see that this holy relationship puts all other relationships into perspective. We honor family, friend, neighbor, stranger. We see that these commandments help us live out the love and justice of God. Still think I'm too soft on sin? Well, let me loop back to that sneaky first commandment and let's try it again. When God said, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me, including yourself. Still think I'm too soft on sin? Lather, rinse, repeat until it clicks. And then join the rest of us who have shrunk, humbled, and are already busy looking for a Moses who will step in and not let God speak to us again anytime soon, or at least until we've had a chance to go home and enjoy the pot roast and carrots and potatoes, maybe a movie and a nap. We have a hymn of response. And it may be that this is a time in your life when you have come to realize that you would like to accept God's gift of salvation through Jesus Christ. You will find this to be one of the most welcoming and nurturing congregations you could ever want to join, where something that significant could happen. I'll be waiting for you right here if that's where you've arrived. You might have a new understanding of your relationship with God, and you might like to come mark that by joining this church and placing your life among this congregation. Or you may have a response right where you are while you're singing the words of the hymn. In any case, let's stand together. We'll sing the hymn of response, number 482. Here I am, Lord.